Jocasta's humorous voice pulled her out of the alluring vision of a dark, hay-lined stall, and Roger's body, naked limbs half seen in the gloom. She glanced up from Jemmy's blissful suckling to where Jocasta sat upon the window seat, the spring light through the casement falling across her face. She looked abstracted, Bree thought, as though she were listening to something faint and far off that only she could hear. Maybe the hum of the wedding guests below. The murmur in the house below reminded her of her mother's summer hives, a thrum that you could hear if you put your ear against one of the bee gums, a distant sound of busy content. The product of this particular swarm was talk rather than honey, though the intent was similar, the laying up of reserves to see them through the bleak and nectarless days of deprivation. "That will do, that will do." Jocasta waved Phaedra away, getting to her feet. She shooed the maid out of the room, then stood, tapping her fingers restlessly on the dressing table, clearly thinking of further details that should be attended to. Jocasta's brows drew together, and she pressed two fingers against the skin above her eyes. "Have you got a headache, auntie?" Brianna kept her voice low so as not to disturb Jemmy, who was nearly asleep. Jocasta dropped her hand and turned toward her niece with a small, wry smile. "Och, it's nothing. Whenever the weather turns, my poor head turns with it." In spite of the smile, Brianna could see small lines of pain tugging at the corners of Jocasta's eyes. "Jem's nearly finished. I'll go and fetch Mama, shall I? She could make you a tisane." Jocasta flapped a hand in dismissal, pushing away the pain with an obvious effort. "No need of yearnin. It's none so bad as that." She rubbed at her temple, careful of the hairdressing, the gesture belying her words. Jemmy's mouth released its hold with a small, milky pop, and his head lolled back. The crook of Brianna's elbow was hot and sweaty where his head had rested. His tiny ear was crumpled and crimson. She lifted his inert body and sighed with relief as the cool air struck her skin. A soft belch bubbled out of him with a dribble of excess milk, and he subsided against her shoulder like a half-filled water balloon. "Full, is he?" Jocasta smiled, blind eyes turned toward them at the faint sound. "As a drum," Brianna assured her. She patted his small back, to be sure, but heard no more than the soft sigh of sleep-filled breathing. She rose, wiped the milk from his chin, and laid the baby on his stomach in his makeshift cradle, a drawer from Jocasta's mahogany chiffonier, laid on the floor and thickly padded with pillows and quilts. Brianna hung the shawl over the back of the chair, shivering slightly in a draught that leaked around the window frame. Not wanting to risk her new dress being stained with spit-up milk, she'd been nursing Jemmy in shift and stockings, and her bare forearms were pebbled with gooseflesh. Jocasta turned her head in answer to the creak of wood and rustle of fabric as Brianna opened the big armoire and took out two linen petticoats and her dress, smoothing the panels of soft, pale blue wool with satisfaction. She had woven the cloth and engineered the design of the gown herself, though Mrs. Bug had spun the thread. Claire had dyed it with indigo and saxifrage, and Masali had helped with the sewing.
"Shall I call Phaedra back to dress you, lass?"
"No, that's all right, I can manage, if you'll help me with the laces." She didn't like to call on the services of the slaves any more than could be helped. The petticoats were no problem. She simply stepped into them, one at a time, and fastened the drawstrings round her waist. The stays needed to be laced up the back, though, and so did the gown itself. Jocasta's brows were still dark, bronze against the pale apricot hue of her skin. They rose a little at the suggestion that she help to dress her niece, but she nodded, with no more than a brief hesitation. She turned her blind eyes toward the hearth, frowning a little.
"I suppose I can. The lad is not too near the fire, is he? Sparks can jump, eh?"
Brianna wriggled into the stays, scooping her breasts up into the scalloped hollows that supported them, then pulled the gown on over them.
"No, he's not too near the fire," she said patiently.
She'd made the bodice with light boning in the front and sides. Brianna turned slightly to and fro, admiring the effect in Jocasta's looking-glass. Catching sight in the mirror of her aunt's slight frown behind her, she rolled her eyes at herself, then bent and pulled the drawer a little farther from the hearth, just in case.
"Thanks to you for humouring an old woman," Jocasta said dryly, hearing the scrape of wood.
"You're welcome, aunt," Brianna replied, letting both warmth and apology show in her voice. She laid a hand on her great-aunt's shoulder, and Jocasta put her own long hand over it, squeezing gently.
"It's no that I think you're a neglectful mother, aye?" Jocasta said. "But when you've lived so long as I have, you may be cautious too, lass."
"I have seen dreadful things happen to bairns, you ken," she said more softly.
"And I should rather be set afire myself than see harm come to our bonny lad."
She moved behind Brianna and ran her hands lightly down her niece's back, finding the lacings without trouble.
"You've regained your figure, I see," the old woman said with approval, her hands skimming the sides of Brianna's waist. "What is this? Cruel work? What colour is it?"
"Dark indigo blue, flowering vines done in heavy cotton to contrast with the pale blue wool." She took one of Jocasta's hands and guided the fingertips lightly over the vines that covered each bone in the bodice, running from the scalloped neck to the V of the waist, dropped sharply in front to show off the trim figure Jocasta had remarked upon. Brianna drew in her breath as the laces tightened, glancing from her reflection to her son's small head, round as a cantaloupe, and heartbreakingly perfect. Not for the first time she wondered about her great-aunt's life. Jocasta had had children, or at least Jamie thought so, but she never spoke of them, and Brianna hesitated to ask. Perhaps lost in infancy, so many were. Her chest tightened at the thought.
"Then fash yourself," her aunt said.
Jocasta's face readjusted itself into determined cheerfulness in the mirror.
"Yon lad is born for great things. Nae harm will come to him, I'm sure."
She turned, the green silk of her dressing gown rustling over her petticoats, leaving Bree freshly startled at her aunt's ability to divine people's feelings, even without seeing their faces.
"Fed," Jocasta called. "Fed, bring me my case, the black one."
Phaedra was nearby, as always, and a brief rustling in the drawers of the armoire produced the black case. Jocasta sat down with it at her secretary.
This ends Disc 21. The Fiery Cross, Disc 22.
The black leather case was old and worn, a narrow box covered in weathered hide, unadorned save for its silver hasp. Jocasta kept her best jewels in a much grander case of velvet-lined cedarwood, Brianna knew. What could be in this one? She moved to stand beside her aunt as Jocasta put back the lid. Inside the case was a short length of turned wood, the thickness of a finger, and on it were ranged three rings, a plain band of gold set with a beryl, another with a large cabochon emerald, and the last with three diamonds surrounded by smaller stones that caught the light and threw it back in rainbows that danced across the walls and beams.
"What a lovely ring!" Bree exclaimed involuntarily. "Oh, the diamond one? Well, Hector Cameron, was I a rich man?" said Jocasta, absently touching the biggest ring.
Her long fingers, unadorned, sorted deftly through a small heap of trinkets that lay in the box beside the rings, and came out with something small and dull. She handed the tiny object to Brianna, who discovered it to be a small, pierced-work tin brooch, rather tarnished, made in the shape of a heart.
"That's a desil charm of yearnin," Jocasta said with a satisfied nod. "Put it on the wain's skirts, behind."
"A charm?" Brianna glanced at Jemmy's huddled form. "What kind of charm?"
"Against the fairies," Jocasta said. "Keep it pinned to the lad's smock, always to the back, mind. And naught born of the old folk would trouble him."
The hair on Brianna's forearms prickled slightly at the matter-of-factness in the old woman's voice.
"Your mother should have told you," Jocasta went on, with a hint of reproval in her voice. "But I ken as she's a Sassenach, and your father likely wouldna think of it." Men don't, she added with a hint of bitterness. It's a woman's job to see to the weans, to keep them from harm.
Jocasta stooped to the kindling basket and groped among the bits of debris, coming up with a long pine twig in her hand, the bark still on it.
Take that, she commanded, holding it out toward Brianna. Light the end of it from the hearth, and walk ye round the bairn 3 times. Sunwise, mind.
Mystified, Brianna took the stick and thrust it into the fire, then did as she was bid, holding the flaming twig well away from both the makeshift cradle and her blue wool skirts. Jocasta tapped her foot rhythmically on the floor and chanted, half under her breath. She spoke in Gaelic, but slowly enough that Brianna could make out most of the words.
Wisdom of serpent be thine, wisdom of raven be thine, wisdom of valiant eagle, voice of swan be thine, voice of honey be thine, voice of the sun of the stars. Scene of the fairy woman be thine, scene of the elf dart be thine, scene of the red dog be thine. Bounty of sea be thine, bounty of land be thine, bounty of the Father of heaven. Be each day glad for thee, no day ill for thee, a life joyful, satisfied.
Jocasta paused for a moment, a slight frown on her face, as though listening for any back talk from fairyland. Evidently satisfied, she motioned toward the hearth.
Throw it into the fire, then the wean will be safe from burning.
Brianna obeyed, finding to her fascination that she didn't find any of this even faintly ridiculous. Odd, but very satisfying to think that she was protecting Jem from harm. Even harm from fairies, which she didn't personally believe in. Or she hadn't, before this. A thread of music drifted up from below, the screech of a fiddle, and the sound of a voice, deep and mellow. She couldn't make out any words, but knew the sound of the song. Jocasta cocked her head, listening, and smiled.
He's a good voice, your young man.
Brianna listened too. Very faintly she heard the familiar rise and fall of My Love is in America, somewhere below.
When I sing, it's always for you.
Her breasts were soft now, drained of milk, but they tingled slightly at the memory.
You have good ears, Auntie,
she said, tucking the thought away with a smile.
Are you pleased in your marriage? Jocasta asked abruptly. Do you find yourself well suited with the lad?
Yes, Brianna said, a little startled. Yes,
very much. That's good.
Her great aunt stood still, head tilted to the side, still listening.
Aye, that's good, she repeated softly.
Seized by impulse, Brianna laid a hand on the older woman's wrist.
And you, Auntie, she asked, are you pleased?
Happy seemed not quite the word, in view of that row of rings in the case.
Well suited seemed not quite right either, with her memory of Duncan skulking in the corner of the drawing room the night before, shy and wordless whenever anyone but Jamie spoke to him, sweating and nervous this morning.
Pleased?
Jocasta sounded puzzled. Oh, to be married, you mean?
To Brianna's relief, her aunt laughed, the lines of her face drawing up in genuine amusement.
Oh, aye, surely, she said. Why, it's the first time I shall have changed my name in 50 years.
With a small snort of amusement, the old lady turned toward the window and pressed her palm against the glass.
It's a fine day out, lass, she said. Why not take your cloak and have a bit of air and company?
She was right. The distant river gleamed silver through a lacework of green branches, and the air inside, so cosy a few moments ago, seemed now suddenly stale and frosty.
I think I will, Brianna glanced toward the makeshift cradle. Shall I call Fed to watch the baby?
Jocasta waved a hand at her, shooing.
Och, away with you. I'll mind the bairnie. I dinna mean to go down yet a while.
Thanks, Auntie. She kissed the old woman's cheek and turned to go. Then, with a glance at her aunt, took a step back toward the hearth and unobtrusively slid the cradle a little farther from the fire. The air outside was fresh and smelled of new grass and barbecue smoke. It made her want to skip down the brick paths, blood humming in her veins. She could hear the strains of music from the house and the sound of Roger's voice. A quick turn in the fresh air, and then she'd go in. Perhaps Roger would be ready for a break by then, and they could...
Brianna!
She heard her name hissed from behind the wall of the kitchen garden, and turned, startled, to find her father's head poking cautiously round the corner like a ruddy snail. He jerked his chin at her and disappeared. She cast a quick look over her shoulder to be sure no one was watching and hastily whisked round the wall into the shelter of a sprouting carrot bed, to find her father crouched over the recumbent body of one of the black maids who was sprawled atop a pile of aging manure with her cap over her face. "What on earth?" Brianna began. Then she caught a whiff of alcohol pungent among the garden scents of carrot tops and sun-ripened manure.
"Oh."
She squatted next to her father, skirts ballooning over the brick path.
"It was my fault," he explained. "Or some of it, at least. I left a cup under the willows, still half full."
He nodded toward the brick path where one of Jocasta's punch cups lay on its side, a sticky drop of liquid still clinging to its rim.
"She must have found it."
Brianna leaned over and sniffed at the edge of the maid's rumpled cap, now fluttering with heavy snores. Rum punch was the prevailing odour, but she also detected the richly sour scent of ale and the smooth tang of brandy. Evidently, the slave had been thriftily disposing of any dregs left in the cup she collected for washing. She lifted the ruffled edge of the cap with a cautious finger. It was Betty, one of the older maids, her face slack-lipped and drop-jawed in alcoholic stupor.
"Aye, it wasn't the first half-cup she'd had," Jamie said, seeing her. "She must have been reeling. I kind of think how she walked so far from the house in such condition."
Brianna glanced back, frowning. The brick-walled kitchen garden was near to the cookhouse, but a good 300 yards from the main house, and separated from it by a rhododendron hedge and several flower beds. "Not just how," Brianna said, and tapped a finger against her lip in puzzlement. "Why?"
"What?"
He'd been frowning at the maid, but glanced up at her tone. She rose and tilted her head at the snoring woman.
"Why did she walk out here? It looks like she's been tippling all day. She can't have been dashing out here with every cup. Somebody would have noticed.
And why bother?
It's not like it would be hard to do without being noticed. If I were drinking leftovers, I'd just stay there under the willows and gulp it."
Her father gave her a startled look, replaced at once with one of wry amusement.
"Would you, then?" "Aye, that's a thought. But perhaps there was enough in the cup that she thought to enjoy it in peace." "Maybe so, but there are surely hiding places near the river than this."
She reached down and scooped up the empty cup.
"What was it you were drinking? Rum punch?" "No, brandy." "Then it wasn't yours that pushed her over the edge."
She held out the cup, tilting it so he could see the dark dregs at the bottom. Jocasta's rum punch was made not only with the usual rum, sugar and butter, but also with dried currants, the whole concoction being mulled with a hot poker. The result not only was dark brown in colour, but always left a heavy sediment in the cups, composed of tiny grains of soot from the poker and the charred remnants of incinerated currants. Jamie took the cup from her, frowning. He inserted his nose into the cup and took a deep sniff, then stuck a finger into the liquid and put it in his mouth.
"What is it?" she asked, seeing his face change.
"Punch," he said, but ran the tip of his tongue back and forth over his teeth as though to cleanse it.
"With laudanum, I think."
"Laudanum? Are you sure?"
"No," he said frankly. "But there's something in it beyond dried currants, or I'm a Dutchman."
He held the cup out to her, and she took it, sniffing furiously. She couldn't make out much beyond the sweet burned smell of rum punch.
Perhaps there was a sharper tang, something oily and aromatic,
perhaps not. "I'll take your word for it," she said, wiping the tip of her nose on the back of her hand. She glanced at the supine maid. "Shall I go look for Mama?" Jamie squatted beside the maid and inspected her carefully. He lifted a limp hand and felt it, listened to her breathing, then shook his head.
"I can't see whether she's drugged or only drunk, but I don't think she's dying."
"What shall we do with her? We can't leave her lie." He looked down at the slave, frowning.
"No, of course not."
He stooped and, quite gently, gathered the woman into his arms. One worn shoe fell off, and Brianna retrieved it from the brick walk.
"Do ken where she sleeps?"
Jamie asked, gingerly negotiating his stertorous burden around the edge of a cucumber frame. "She's a house slave. She must sleep in the attics." He nodded, tossing his head to dislodge a strand of red hair that had blown into his mouth.
"Very well, then. We'll go round the stables and see if we can get up the back stair without being seen. Go across, will you, lass, and signal me when it's clear."
She tucked shoe and cup under her cloak to hide them, then ducked quickly out onto the narrow walk that led past the kitchen garden, branching to cookhouse and necessary. She glanced to and fro, feigning casualness. There were a few people within sight near the paddock, but that was some distance away, and all of them had their backs to her, engrossed with Mr. Wiley's black Dutch horses. As she turned to signal to her father, she caught sight of Mr. Wiley himself, escorting a lady into the stable block. A gleam of gold silk. Wait, it was her mother. Claire's pale face turned momentarily in her direction, but her attention was fixed on something Wiley was saying, and she didn't notice her daughter on the path. Bree hesitated, wanting to call to her mother, but couldn't do so without attracting unwanted attention. Well, at least she knew where Claire was. She could come and fetch her mother to help, once they had Betty safely tucked away. With a few close alarms and near misses, they managed to get Betty up to the long attic room she shared with the other female house servants. Jamie, panting, dumped her unceremoniously on one of the narrow beds, then wiped his sweating brow on his coat sleeve, and, long nose wrinkled, began fastidiously to dust manure crumbs from the skirts of his coat.
"So then," he said, a little grumpily, "she's safe, aye. If you tell one of the other slaves she's taken ill, I suppose no one who matters will find out."
"Thanks, Dar." She leaned close and kissed his cheek. "You're a sweet man."
"Oh, aye," he said, sounding resigned. "My bones are filled with honey, to be sure."
Still, he didn't look displeased.
"Have you got that shoe still?"
He took off the maid's remaining shoe and placed it neatly beside its fellow beneath the bed, then drew the coarse woolen blanket gently over the woman's feet, grimy white in their thick stockings. Brianna checked the maid's condition. So far as she could tell, everything seemed all right. The woman was still snoring wetly, but in a reassuringly regular manner. As they tiptoed cautiously back down the rear stairs, she gave Jamie the silver cup. "Here, did you know this was one of Duncan's cups?"
"No."
He arched one brow, frowning.
"What do you mean, Duncan's cups?"
"Aunt Jocasta had a set of 6 cups made for Duncan for a wedding present. She showed them to me yesterday. See?" She turned the cup in her hand to show him the engraved monogram, I for Innes, with a tiny fish, its scales beautifully detailed, swimming round the letter.
"Does that help?" she asked, seeing his brow crease in interest. "It may."
He pulled out a clean cambric handkerchief and wrapped the cup carefully before putting it in the pocket of his coat.
"I'll go and find out. Meanwhile, can you find Roger Mark?"
"Of course." "Why?"
"Well, it does occur to me that if you and Betty drank part of a cup of rum punch and was laid out like a fish on a slab, then I should like to find whoever drank the first part of it and see if they're in a similar condition."
He raised one brow at her.
"If the punch was drugged, then likely it was meant for someone, aye? I thought perhaps you and Roger Mark might look round discreetly for bodies in the shrubbery."
That aspect of the matter hadn't struck her in the rush to get Betty upstairs. All right. I should find Phaedra or Ulysses first, though, and tell one of them that Betty's sick.
Aye. If you speak with Phaedra, you might inquire whether yon Betty is an opium eater as well as a bibber. Though I will say I think it unlikely, he added dryly.
So do I, she said, matching his tone. She took his point, though. Perhaps the punch hadn't been drugged, but Betty had taken the laudanum herself, on purpose. It was possible. She knew Jocasta kept some in the stillroom. If she had taken it herself, though, was it for recreational use? Or had the maid perhaps intended to commit suicide? She frowned at Jamie's back as he paused at the foot of the stair, listening before stepping onto the landing. It was easy enough to think that the misery of slavery might dispose one to suicide. At the same time, honesty compelled her to admit that Jocasta's house servants lived reasonably well, better than any number of free individuals, black or white, that she'd seen in Wilmington and Cross Creek. The servants' room was clean, the beds rough but comfortable. The house servants had decent clothes, even to shoes and stockings, and more than enough to eat. As for the sorts of emotional complications that could lead one to contemplate suicide, well, those weren't limited to slaves. Much more likely that Betty was merely a toper, of the sort who would drink anything even vaguely alcoholic. The reek of her garments certainly suggested as much. But in that case, why take the risk of stealing laudanum on a day when the wedding party ensured there would be an abundance of every kind of drink? She was reluctantly forced to the same conclusion that she was sure her father had already reached. Betty had taken the laudanum, if that's what it was, she reminded herself, by accident. And if that was so, whose cup had she drunk from? Jamie turned, lips pursed to enjoin silence, and beckoned to her that the coast was clear. She followed him quickly across the landing and outside, letting out her breath in relief as they arrived on the path unobserved.
"What were you doing there in the first place, Dar?" she asked.
He looked blank.
"In the kitchen garden," she elaborated.
"How did you find Betty?"
"Oh."
He took her arm, fetching her away from the house. They walked casually toward the paddock, innocent guests bent on viewing the horses.
"I was just having a word with your mother over by the groove. I came back through the kitchen garden, and there the woman was, flat on her back on the shit heap."
"Well, that's a point, isn't it?" she asked. "Did she lie down in the garden on purpose? Or was it only an accident that you found her there?"
He shook his head.
"I dinna ken," he said. "But I mean to speak to Betty once she's sober. Do you care where your mother is now?"
"Yes, she's with Philip Wiley. They were headed for the stables, I think."
Her father's nostrils flared slightly at mention of Wiley, and she suppressed a smile.
"I'll find her," he said. "Meanwhile, lass, do you go and speak to Phaedra? And, lass..."
She had already turned to go. At this, she looked back, surprised.
"I think perhaps you should tell Fed to say nothing unless someone asks her where Betty is. And if they do, to tell you or me."
He straightened abruptly, clearing his throat.
"Go find your husband then, lass. And, lass, make sure no one kens what you're about, aye?"
He lifted one brow, and she nodded in reply. He turned on his heel then, and strode off toward the stables, the fingers of his right hand tapping gently against his coat as though he were deep in thought. The chilly wind nipped under her skirts and petticoats, belling them out and sending a deep shiver through her flesh. She understood his implication well enough. If it was neither attempted suicide nor accident, then it might be intended murder. But of whom? Chapter 43. Flirtations. Jamie had given me a lingering kiss for encouragement after our interlude, and crashed off through the underbrush, intending to hunt down Ninian Bell Hamilton and find out just what the regulators were up to at the camp Hunter had mentioned.
I followed, after a moment's interval for decency, but paused at the edge of the grove before emerging back into public view to be sure I was seemly. I had a rather light-headed sense of well-being, and my cheeks were very flushed, but I thought that wasn't incriminating in and of itself. Neither would coming out of the wood be inculpatory. Women and men alike often simply stepped into the shelter of the trees along the lawn in order to relieve themselves, rather than making their way to the overcrowded and smelly necessaries. Coming out of the wood flushed and breathing heavily, with leaves in my hair and sap stains on my skirt, though, would cause a certain amount of comment behind the fans. There were a few sand burrs and an empty cicada shell clinging to my skirt, a ghostly excrescence that I picked off with a shudder of distaste. There were dogwood petals on my shoulder. I brushed them off and felt carefully over my hair, dislodging a few more that fluttered away like scraps of fragrant paper. Just as I stepped out from under the trees, it occurred to me to check the back of my skirt for stains or bits of bark, and I was craning my neck to see over my shoulder when I walked slap into Philip Wiley. "Mrs. Fraser," he caught me by the shoulders to prevent my falling backward. "Are you quite all right, my dear?" "Yes, certainly." My cheeks were flaming legitimately at this point, and I stepped back, shaking myself back into order. Why did I keep bumping into Philip Wiley? Was the little pest following me? I do apologize.
"Nonsense, nonsense," he said heartily. "It was my fault entirely. Deuced clumsy of me. May I get you something to restore your spirits, my dear? A glass of cider? Wine? Rum punch? A syllabub? Applejack? Or, no, brandy? Yes, allow me to bring you a bit of brandy to recover from the shock."
"No, nothing, thank you." I couldn't help laughing at his absurdities, and he grinned back, obviously thinking himself very witty.
"Well, if you're quite recovered then, dear lady, you must come with me. I insist."
He had my hand tucked into the crook of his arm and was towing me determinedly off in the direction of the stable, despite my protests.
"It will take no more than a moment," he assured me. "I've been looking forward all day to showing you my surprise. You will be utterly entranced, I give you my word."
I subsided feebly. It seemed less trouble to go and look at the damned horses again than to argue with him, and there was plenty of time to speak with Jocasta before the wedding, in any case. This time, though, we skirted the paddock where Lucas and his companions were submitting tolerantly to inspection by a couple of bold gentlemen who had climbed the fence for a closer look. "That is an amazingly good-tempered stallion," I said with approval, mentally contrasting Lucas's kindly manners with Gideon's rapacious personality. Jamie still hadn't found time to castrate the horse, who had consequently bitten almost everyone, horse and man alike, on the journey to River Run.
"A mark of the breed,"
Wiley replied, pushing open the door that led to the main stable.
"They are the most amiable of horses, though a gentle disposition does not impair their intelligence, I do assure you. This way, Mrs. Fraser."
By contrast with the brilliant day outside, it was pitch dark in the stable, so dark that I stumbled over an uneven brick in the floor, and Mr. Wiley seized my arm as I lurched forward with a startled cry.
"Are you all right, Mrs. Fraser?" he asked, setting me upright again.
"Yes," I said, a little breathless. In fact, I had both stubbed my toe viciously and turned my ankle. My new Morocco-heeled shoes were lovely, but I wasn't used to them yet. "Just let me stand a moment, till my eyes adjust." He did, but he didn't let go of my arm. Instead, he pulled my hand through the crook of his elbow and set it solidly, to give me more support.
"Lean on me," he said simply.
I did, and we stood quietly for a moment, me with my injured foot drawn up like a heron's, waiting for my toes to stop throbbing. For once, Mr. Wiley seemed bereft of quips and sallies, perhaps because of the peaceful atmosphere. Stables, on the whole, are peaceful, horses and the people who tend them being generally kindly sorts of creatures. This one, though, had a special air, both quiet and vibrant. I could hear small rustlings and stampings,
and the contented noise of a horse champing hay close at hand. So close to Philip Wiley, I was aware of his perfume, but even the expensive whiff of musk and bergamot was overcome by the stable smells. It smelled of fresh straw and grain, of brick and wood, but there was a faint scent as well of more elemental things, manure and blood and milk, the basic elements of motherhood. "It's rather womb-like in here, isn't it?" I said softly. "So warm and dark. I mean, I can almost feel the heartbeat." Wiley laughed, but quietly. "That's mine," he said. He touched a hand briefly to his waistcoat, a dark shadow against the pale satin. My eyes adapted quickly to the dark, but even so the place was very dim. The lithe shadow shape of a stable cat glided past, making me wobble and set down my injured foot. It wouldn't yet bear weight, but I could at least put it to the floor. "Can you stand for a moment alone?" Wiley asked. Without waiting for my reply, he detached himself and went to light a lantern that stood on a nearby stool. There were a few faint chinks of flint and steel, then the wick caught, and a soft globe of yellow light ballooned around us. Taking my arm again with his free hand, he led me toward the far end of the stable. They were in the loose box at the end. Philip raised the lantern high, turning to smile at me as he did so. The lantern light gleamed on hide that shone and rippled like midnight water, and glowed in the huge brown eyes of the mare as she turned toward us.
"Oh," I said softly, "how beautiful."
And then, a little louder,
"Oh!"
The mare had moved a little, and her foal peered out from behind her mother's legs. She was long-legged and knob-kneed, her tiny rump and sloping shoulders rounded echoes of her mother's muscular perfection. She had the same large, kind eyes, fringed with long, long lashes. But instead of the sleek hide of rippling black, she was a dark reddish-brown, and fuzzy as a rabbit, with an absurd little whisk-broom of a tail. Her dam had the same glorious profusion of flowing mane I had noted on the Frisians in the paddock. The baby had a ridiculous crest of stiff hair, about an inch long, that stuck straight up like a toothbrush. The foal blinked once, dazzled by the light, then ducked swiftly behind the shelter of her mother's body. A moment later, a small nose protruded cautiously into sight, nostrils twitching. A big eye followed, blinked, and the nose vanished, only to reappear almost instantly a little further this time.
"Why, you little flirt," I said, delighted.
Wiley laughed. "She is indeed," he said, voice filled with pride of ownership. "Are they not magnificent?"
"Well, yes," I said, considering. "They are. Still, I'm not sure that's quite it. Magnificent seems more like what you'd say of a stallion or a war horse of some kind. These horses are, well, they're sweet."
Wiley gave a small, amused sort of snort.
"Sweet," he said. "Sweet.
Well, you know," I said, laughing. "Charming, good-natured, delightful."
"All those things," he said, turning to me. "And beautiful as well."
He wasn't looking at the horses, but rather at me, a faint smile on his face.
"Yes," I said, feeling a small, obscure twinge of unease. "Yes, they are very beautiful."
He was standing very close. I took a step to the side and turned away under the pretext of looking at the horses again. The foal was nuzzling at the mare's swollen udder, scraggy tail waggling with enthusiasm.
"What are their names?" I asked.
Wiley moved to the bar of the loose box, casually, but in such a way that his arm brushed my sleeve as he reached above me to hang the lantern from a hook on the wall.
"The mare's name is Tessa," he said. "You saw the sire, Lucas. As for the filly..."
He reached for my hand and lifted it, smiling.
"I thought I might name her La Belle Claire."
I didn't move for a second. stunned by sheer disbelief at the expression that showed quite clearly on Philip Wiley's face.
"What?" I said blankly. Surely I was wrong, I thought.
I tried to snatch my hand away, but I had hesitated 1 second too long, and his fingers tightened on mine.
Surely he wasn't really meaning to...
He was.
Charming, he said softly,
and moved closer.
Good-natured, delightful,
and
beautiful.
He kissed me.
I was so shocked that I didn't move for a moment.
His mouth was soft, the kiss brief and chaste.
That hardly mattered, though. It was the fact that he had done it. Mr. Wiley, I said.
I took a hasty step back, but was brought up short by the rail.
Mrs. Fraser,
he said softly, and took the same step forward.
My dear.
I am not your... I began, and he kissed me again, without the least hint of chasteness.
Still shocked, but no longer stunned, I shoved him hard. He wobbled and lost his grip on my hand, but recovered instantly, seizing me by the arm and slipping his other hand behind me. Flirt, he whispered, and lowered his face toward mine. I kicked him. Unfortunately, I kicked him with my injured foot, which deprived the blow of much force, and he ignored it.
I began to struggle in good earnest as the sense of stunned disbelief faded into the awareness that the young man had one hand firmly on my backside. At the same time, I was aware that there were a good many people in the vicinity of the stable. The last thing I wanted was to attract attention.
"Stop that," I hissed. "Stop it at once." "You madden me," he breathed, pressing me to his bosom and attempting to stick his tongue in my ear. I certainly thought he was mad, but I declined absolutely to accept any responsibility for the condition. I jerked back as far as I could, not far, with a railing at my back, and fought to get one hand between us. Shock quite gone by now, I was thinking with surprising clarity. I couldn't knee him in the balls. He had one leg thrust between my own, trapping a wadge of skirt in my way. If I could get my hand round his throat and get a sound hold of his carotids, though, he'd drop like a rock. I did get hold of his throat, but his blasted stock was in the way. My fingers scrabbled at it, and he jerked to the side, grabbing at my hand. "Please," he said. "I want..." "I don't give a damn what you want," I said. "Let go of me this instant, you... you..." I groped wildly for some suitable insult. "You puppy!" Rather to my surprise, he stopped. His face couldn't go pale, being already covered in rice flour. I could taste it on my lips. But his mouth was set, and his expression was rather wounded. "Is that what you really think of me?" he asked in a low voice.
"Yes, it bloody is," I said. "What else am I to think? Have you lost your mind, behaving in this despicable fashion? What is the matter with you?"
"Despicable?"
He seemed quite taken aback to hear his advances described in this fashion.
"But I... that is, you. I thought you were, I mean, might be not averse."
"You can't," I said positively. "You can't possibly have thought anything of the sort. I've never given you the slightest reason to think such a thing." Nor had I, intentionally. The uneasy thought came to me, though, that perhaps my perceptions of my own behaviour were not quite the same as Philip Wiley's.
"Oh, haven't you?"
His face was changing, clouding with anger.
"I beg to differ with you, madam."
I had told him I was old enough to be his mother. It had never for a moment occurred to me that he didn't believe it.
"Flirt," he said again, though in quite a different tone than the first time. "No reason. You have given me every reason since the first occasion of our meeting."
"What?" My voice went up a tone, in incredulity. "I've never done anything but engage you in civil conversation."
"If that constitutes flirtation in your book, my lad, then..." "Don't call me that."
Oh, so he had noticed that there was a difference of age. He simply hadn't appreciated the magnitude, I thought.
It came to me, with a certain feeling of apprehension, that at Philip's level of society, most flirtation was indeed conducted under the guise of banter.
What in the name of God had I said to him? I had some dim recollection of having discussed the Stamp Act with him and his friend Stanhope. Yes, taxes and, I thought, horses. But surely that couldn't have been sufficient to inflame his misapprehensions.
"Thine eyes are like the fish pools in Heshbon," he said, low-voiced and bitter. "Do you not recall the evening when I said that to you? The Song of Solomon is merely civil conversation to you, is it?"
Good grief. I was, despite myself, beginning to feel slightly guilty. We had had a brief exchange along those lines, at Jocasta's party, 2 or 3 years ago. And he remembered it? The Song of Solomon was reasonably heady stuff. Perhaps the simple reference... Then I shook myself mentally and drew myself up straight. "Nonsense," I declared. "You were teasing me, and I simply answered you in kind. Now I really must..."
"You came in here with me today, alone."
He took another step toward me, eyes determined. He was talking himself back into it, the fat-headed popinjay. "Mr. Wiley," I said firmly, sliding sideways, "I am terribly sorry if you have somehow misunderstood the situation, but I am very happily married, and I have no romantic interest in you whatsoever. And now, if you will excuse me..." I ducked past him and hurried out of the stable as fast as my shoes would allow. He made no effort to follow me, though, and I reached the outdoors unmolested, my heart beating fast. There were people near the paddock. I turned in the other direction, going round the end of the stable block before anyone should see me. Once out of sight, I made a swift inventory, checking to be sure that I didn't look too dishevelled. I didn't know whether anyone had seen me going into the stable with Wiley. I could only hope no one had seen my hasty exit. Only one lock of hair had come down in the recent contretemps. I pinned it carefully back and dusted a few bits of straw from my skirts. Fortunately, he hadn't torn my clothes, a retucked kerchief, and I was quite decent again.
"Are you all right, Sassenach?"
I leapt like a gaffed salmon, and so did my heart. I whirled, adrenaline jolting through my chest like an electric current, to find Jamie standing beside me, frowning slightly as he surveyed me.
"What have you been doing, Sassenach?"
My heart was still stuck in my throat, choking me, but I forced out what I hoped were a few nonchalant words. "Nothing. I mean, looking at the horses." "Horse. The mare. She has a new foal."
"Aye, a new," he said, looking at me oddly.
"Did you find Ninian? What did he have to say?" I groped behind my head, tidying my hair, and taking the opportunity to turn away a little to avoid his eye.
"He says it's through. Though I hadn't doubted it. There are more than 1,000 men camped near Salisbury, and more joining them each day, he says. The old mumper is pleased about it."
He frowned, drumming the 2 stiff fingers of his right hand lightly against his leg, and I realised that he was rather worried. Not without cause. Putting aside the threat of conflict itself, it was spring. Only the fact that River Run was in the Piedmont had allowed us to come to Jocasta's wedding. Down here, the woods were cloudy with blossom, and crocuses popped through the earth like orange and purple dragon's teeth. But the mountains were still cloaked in snow, the tree branches sporting swollen buds. In 2 weeks or so, those buds would burst, and it would be time for the spring planting on Fraser's Ridge. True, Jamie had provided for such an emergency by finding old Arch Bug, but Arch could manage only so much by himself. And as for the tenants and homesteaders, if the militia were raised again, the women would be left to do the planting alone. "The men in this camp, they're men who've left their land, then?" Salisbury was in the Piedmont as well. It wasn't thinkable for working farmers to abandon their land at this time of the year for the sake of protest against the government, no matter how annoyed they were.
"Left it, or lost it," he said briefly.
The frown deepened as he looked at me.
"Have you spoken with my aunt?"
No, I said, feeling guilty. Not yet. I was just going. Oh, you said there was another problem. What else has happened? He made a sound like a hissing tea kettle, which for him betokened rare impatience. Christ, I'd nearly forgotten her. One of the slave women's been poisoned, I think. What? Who? How? My hands dropped from my hair as I stared at him. Why didn't you tell me?
I am telling you, am I not? Dinna fash yourself. She's in no danger. Only stinking drunk.
He twitched his shoulders irritably.
The only difficulty is that perhaps it wasn't her that was meant to be poisoned. I've sent Roger Mack and Brianna to look, and they've not come back to say anyone's dead, so maybe not.
Maybe not? I rubbed the bridge of my nose, distracted from the extant worries by this new development.
I grant you alcohol is poisonous, not that anyone ever seems to realise it. But there's a difference between being drunk and being deliberately poisoned.
What do you mean?
Sassenach, he interrupted.
What?
What in the name of God have you been doing?
He burst out. I stared at him in bewilderment. His face had been growing redder as we talked, though I had supposed it to be only frustration and worry over Ninian and the regulators.
It dawned on me, catching a dangerous blue glint in his eye, that there was something rather more personal about his attitude.
I tilted my head to one side, giving him a wary look.
What do you mean? What have I been doing?
His lips pressed tight together, and he didn't answer. Instead, he extended a forefinger and touched it, very delicately, beside my mouth. He turned his hand over then, and presented me with a small dark object clinging to the tip of his finger. Philip Wiley's star-shaped black beauty mark.
Oh.
I felt a distinct buzzing in my ears.
That.
My head felt light, and small spots, all shaped like black stars, danced before my eyes.
Yes, that, he snapped. Christ, woman! I'm devil to death with Duncan's heavers and Ninian's pranks. And why did you not tell me he'd been fighting with Barlow?
I'd scarcely describe it as a fight, I said, struggling to regain a sense of coolness. Besides, Major MacDonald put a stop to it since you were nowhere to be found. And if you want to be told things, the Major wants...
I ken what he wants.
He dismissed the Major with a curt flick of his hand.
Aye. I'm up to my ears in majors and regulators and drunken maidservants, and you're out in the stable canoodling with that fop.
I felt the blood rising behind my eyes and curled my fists in order to control the impulse to slap him.
I was not canoodling in the slightest degree, and you know it. The beastly little twerp made a pass at me, that's all. A pass? Made love to you, you mean? Aye, I can see that.
He did not?
Oh, aye. You ask him to let you try his bobby on for luck, then?
He waggled the finger with the black patch under my nose, and I slapped it away, recalling a moment too late that make love to merely meant to engage in amorous flirtation rather than fornication.
I mean, I said, through clenched teeth, that he kissed me. Probably for a joke. I'm old enough to be his mother, for God's sake. More like his grandmother.
Jamie said brutally.
Kissed you forby. Why in hell did you encourage him, Sassenach?
My mouth dropped open in outrage, insulted as much at being called Philip Wiley's grandmother as at the accusation of having encouraged him.
Encourage him? Why, you bloody idiot, you know perfectly well I didn't encourage him. Your own daughter saw you go in there with him. Have you no shame? With all else there is to deal with here, am I to be forced to call the man out as well?
I felt a slight qualm at the thought of Brianna, and a larger one at the thought of Jamie challenging Wiley to a duel. He wasn't wearing his sword, but he'd brought it with him. I stoutly dismissed both thoughts.
My daughter is neither a fool nor an evil-minded gossip, I said, with immense dignity. She wouldn't think a thing of my going to look at a horse, and why ought she? Why ought anyone, for that matter?
He blew out a long breath through pursed lips and glared at me.
Why, indeed?
Perhaps because everyone saw you flirt with him on the lawn. Because they saw him follow you about like a dog after a bitch in heat.
He must have seen my expression alter dangerously at that, for he coughed briefly and hurried on.
More than one person seemed fit to mention it to me. Do you think I like being made a public laughingstock, Sassenach?
You... Fury choked me. I wanted to hit him, but I could see interested heads turning toward us.
Bitch in heat! How dare you say such a thing to me, you bloody bastard!
He had the decency to look slightly abashed at that, though he was still glowering.
Aye, well, I shouldn't have said it quite that way. I didn't mean. But you did go off with him, Sassenach. As though I hadn't enough to contend with. My own wife. And if you'd gone to see my aunt as I asked you, then it wouldn't have happened in the first place. Now see what you've done.
I had changed my mind about the desirability of a duel. I wanted Jamie and Philip Wiley to kill each other promptly, publicly, and with the maximum amount of blood. I also didn't care who was looking. I made a very serious effort to castrate him with my bare hands, and he grabbed my wrists, pulling them up sharply.
Christ! Folk are watching, Sassenach!
I don't bloody care, I hissed, struggling to get free.
Let go of me and I'll fucking give them something to watch.
I didn't take my eyes off his face, but I was aware of a good many other faces turning toward us in the crowd on the lawn. So was he. His brows drew together for a moment, then his face set in sudden decision.
All right, then, he said. Let them watch.
He wrapped his arms round me, pressing me tight against himself, and kissed me. Unable to get loose, I quit fighting and went stiff and furious instead. In the distance, I could hear laughter and raucous whoops of encouragement. Ninian Hamilton shouted something in Gaelic that I was pleased not to understand. He finally moved his lips off mine, still holding me tightly against him, and very slowly bent his head, his cheek lying cool and firm next to mine. His body was firm too, and not at all cool. The heat of him was leeching through at least 6 layers of cloth to reach my own skin. Shirt, waistcoat, coat, gown, shift, and stays. Whether it was anger, arousal, or both, he was fully stoked and blazing like a furnace.
"I'm sorry," he said quietly, his breath hot and tickling in my ear. "I didn't mean to insult you. Truly. Shall I kill him, and then myself?"
I relaxed, very slightly. My hips were pressed solidly against him, and with only 5 layers of fabric between us there, the effect was reassuring. "Perhaps not quite yet," I said. I felt light-headed from the rush of adrenaline and took a deep breath to steady myself. Then I drew back a little, recoiling from the pungent reek that wafted off his clothes. Had I not been so upset, I would have noticed immediately that he was the source of the vile aroma I had been smelling.
"What on earth have you been doing?"
I sniffed at the breast of his coat, frowning.
"You smell terrible, like..."
"Manure,"
he said, sounding resigned.
"Aye, I know."
His arms relaxed.
"Yes, manure," I said, sniffing further. "And rum punch."
He hadn't been drinking rum punch himself, though. I had tasted nothing but brandy when he kissed me.
"And something awful, like old sweat and..."
"Boiled turnips,"
he said, sounding more resigned.
"Aye, the maidservant I was telling you about, Sassenach. Betty, she's called."
He tucked my hand into the crook of his arm, and with a deep bow of acknowledgement toward the crowd, who all applauded, damn them, turned to steer me toward the house.
"It would be as well if you can get anything sensible out of her," he said, with a glance toward the sun, which hung in mid-sky above the tops of the willows along the river. "But it's growing late. I think perhaps you'd best go up and speak to my aunt first, if there's to be a wedding at 4 o'clock.
I took a deep breath, trying to settle myself. A good deal of unexpended emotion was still sloshing round inside me, but there was plainly work to do.
"Right then," I said. "I'll see Jocasta, and then have a look at Betty."
As for Philip Wiley...
As for Philip Wiley, he interrupted, dinna give him another thought, Sassenach.
A certain look of inward intentness grew in his eyes.
I'll take